Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are my colleagues at Investors Chronicle, Deputy Personal Finance Editor Kate Bailey and Personal Finance Writer Emma Adjumang, and Monica Tepes, Director of Investment Companies Research at Cantor Fitzgerald, is also joining us. The UK market is highly reliant on just a handful of companies for most of its dividend haul, meaning that even if only one of these cuts its dividend, it can have a serious knock-on effect on the UK equity income funds and investors that rely on it. One solution to this is to diversify your sources of income by investing in a global equity income fund, such as the one we've highlighted in this week's fund tip. See the magazine or the website for more details. But another option is to turn away from traditional sources of income such as equities and bonds and invest in a fund focused on alternative and higher yielding areas. Monica, you do a lot of research on alternative income investment trusts. So what are some of the areas you can access with them?
Well, there's quite a few of them, actually. So over the last few years, there have been a lot of new launches. So now you can invest in funds in infrastructure, renewable energy generation, direct lending, P2P lending, and even more esoteric ones such as aviation leasing, mortgages, structured credit, reinsurance. And there's been new launches also in property, including some specialist areas of property such as student accommodation.
Okay. Now, what sort of level of yield can you expect at the moment from these types of investment trusts?
Well, in terms of the risk, it all depends on the risk that you are of the underlying asset class. So they tend to range from about 4.5% to, at the safer end, let's say, to 10% plus at the riskier end.
Okay, I mean, that's really attractive, but how sustainable and how reliable are these areas as income sources?
Well, it depends very much in the asset classes and the strategies within the asset classes, but some of them are very reliable. So the reason that these asset classes got so much interest was precisely for that characteristics. So, for example, in infrastructure, you can have effectively government-backed cash flows that can go up 20, 30 years plus, which are contracted. So they're now dependent on a company's profitability, and they also have inflation linkage characteristics. So as inflation goes up, those cash flows will go up. You will also have riskier assets where you may have leveraged exposure to companies' credit, in which case, if you happen to be invested at the wrong time in the credit cycle, you may not see the returns that you are expecting to receive. So it all very much depends. But I would say that the majority of these funds will have a degree of sustainability, because that's the reason they made it to market, because that's what investors are looking for.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned quite a few areas. What would you say out of these is particularly attractive to invest in at the moment?
Well, thinking of what the alternatives are, I would say pretty much, well, a lot of them, or depends what you're looking for, the kind of risk that you're looking to take on, or what kind of exposure you're looking to have. So if, for example, you thought that energy prices are likely to go up over the medium long term, then you'd probably want to be looking at the renewables funds, where you will have pretty much direct exposure. Half or so of the revenues are pretty much come from electricity prices.
This is from things like wind farms and solar plants.
That's right, yeah. Yes. So it all very much depends on what you are looking for, or you could have more fixed type of income, where it pretty much comes in essentially the coupon of a bond.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, what would be some examples of investment trusts that invest in the wind and solar farms and the bonds you refer to?
So, in terms of renewable energy, there's six funds out there. So, you have some choice. There's three solar funds, there's a wind farm, and there is two that are mixed. So, they invest both in solar assets and in wind assets. in terms of market cap, altogether they are over 3.5 billion. So these are established funds, names that may be familiar to some people will be Bluefield Solar Income, Next Energy Solar, Greencoat UK Wind, John Lang Environmental Assets. So there is quite a choice up there, and they all yield around the 6% mark.
Okay. So what would be one or two examples of the sort of bond debt, alternative bond debt investment trusts?
So again, it's a safe end, infrastructure debt. So these are bonds that ultimately are backed by cash flows that are quasi-government. So here there's GCP infrastructure, Sequoia economic infrastructure income, and they are yielding again about 5.5-6%. And these are essentially, you are essentially investing in bonds. So there will be a coupon. There might be some degree of inflation linkage, but ultimately, unless the issuer defaults, you are going to get that income.
Okay, now this sounds great. You know, high income, inflation linkage, sort of fairly safe assets. But there's always two sides to any story. So what are the risks, let's say, first of all, of investing in renewables investment trusts? And secondly, of debt investment trusts?
Well, there's nothing in this world, I think, is risk-free. But thinking of renewables, for example, so the big risk there is, of course, the electricity price. So if you find that, you know, maybe we will live in a world where electricity is pretty much free, then there will be a problem because I said about 40% of the cash flows there come from electricity prices. You also need a good manager. Because if you the manager is not investing in the right assets, looking after them properly, then you could have problems that they are not functioning as they should do, and they're not generating electricity.
Yeah.
Thinking of the debt funds, there are a variety of there. There will be some at the safer end, some such as those that are financing infrastructure projects, where ultimately the government is behind those cash flows. But also you could be investing in funds that have leverage exposure to corporate bonds. So these will be companies producing product services. So ultimately, if those default, and those defaults are above a certain level, then your returns could be a lot lower than what you expected, or also could be negative.
Okay, just one thought. These funds are obviously investment trusts, and investment trusts usually trade not at par, but at discounts, so at premiums. Whereabouts are these renewables and these debt funds trading? Are they at discounts or are they at premiums?
Most of them are on premiums. So all the renewables funds are premiums within the credit space, if you like. There will be some that are on very high premium, the safer one, and there will be some that could be trading at or are trading at a discount at the riskier end, where you have leverage exposure, or you're investing in sort of the riskier trenches within a securitized or in a structured security. So it very much depends. But talking about what the risks are or the downside, so those would be twofold. So one, you'll have the underlying assets, how they are performing. But also, unless you're a very, very long-term investor and you're looking at where your price of your investment is at any one time, you also, there's a valuation risk of those assets.
Yes.
So actually there would be three level, because there's a valuation of the underlying assets, which may still be paying the cash flows that you expect from them, but their prices could vary depending on a lot of reasons, supply demands being one of them. And also is the valuation of the investment trust itself. So that could go from trading at a premium to trading at a discount.
Yeah.
So which if you're looking to sell when it's trading at a discount and you bought it at a premium, then it is a problem. If you're investing for the long term, and you can tolerate that volatility, and the underlying investment is performing well, then you will be fine.
Yeah, I guess that's quite an issue for a lot of income generating funds trading at a premium, isn't it? Yeah,
because that's where the great demand is.
Just thinking, thinking specifically about the renewables, if I remember correctly, quite a lot of them are on premiums. Mm-hmm. Do you think people should be buying into them on premiums? Because obviously, if they continue to be popular and people hold them for a long time, it's less of an issue. Do you think it's, you know, do you think people should buy them at premiums or just avoid them?
I think one should not be afraid of a premium just because it's a premium. It very much depends on the assets you're investing in, what your exposures are, the risks are, and also what you think about the future. If you think that electricity prices are only going to go down from here, then you shouldn't buy these. If, however, you think that, you know, you're worried that your electricity bill is going up every year, and you then probably this would be kind of a hedge against it. You're also benefiting when prices go up. Thinking of this, the premium, ultimately, it's a combination of the yields that you're getting. So even if these funds are trading on a premium, you're still getting a decent yield, which is around 6%. Mm. And also, do you think that the underlying assets are going to... are property value. So there is an argument, one could say, that maybe that the way these assets are valued, they are essentially undervalued, that given the characteristics they have, the inflation protection that comes with them, some might say that actually I'm willing to pay more for these assets. There is a demand for them. Ultimately, everything is about demand and supply. So if you thought that the underlying assets were undervalued, then you actually paying a premium, you could see that you're getting them at fair value. So it's there's no easy answer, but it very much depends on the returns that you're happy to take for the risk in these assets.
Yeah, and I guess your time scale.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now obviously... these are all investment trusts, and I think it's fair to say that many of these alternative income areas can be accessed with investment trusts, but not necessarily open-ended funds. Mm-hmm. Why is this?
It all comes down to liquidity. So probably property is one sector where there are a lot of open-ended funds, despite the fact that the underlying assets are illiquid. It has been proved... generally, it happens every cycle that some of these will stop investors from taking their money out at certain times, or they will change the pricing, so it will be penalized for taking your money out. In a closed-end format, you can sell your investment at any time. Of course, you will be taking the discount risk. Mm. But that's what it comes down to. So if you have the closed-end format, the manager is not forced at any time to sell any assets, which you would unlikely to get a good price if it was a forced sale. It's a great format for them. And that's why over the last 3, 4, 5 years, there have been so many new launches. And now there's close to 100 funds that invest in illiquid, or 100 closed-end funds that invest in illiquid assets.
Okay, thank you, Monica. Some really interesting insights and helpful points. Now, yesterday saw the start of the 2017-18 tax year, which, as well as bringing with it a new round of tax allowances, like the whopping $20,000 a year ISA allowance, it also marks the launch of a new tax wrapper, the Lifetime Individual Savings Account, or LISA for short. Kate, you've been looking at this, so can you tell us a little bit about LISA and how she's different to other types of ISA?
So this is an ISA designed for first-time buyers, essentially, but with a bit more flexibility than the Help to Buy ISA, which is already out there in the market. So the idea is that you get the 25% government bonus on your contributions if you use this ISA to buy a home worth up to £450,000, or if you keep the money invested until you're age 60. So it could either be a retirement tool or it could be a first-time buyer tool. Now, there's a limit to how much you can save. You can put £4,000 into it each year, but you can put that in either lump sums or save monthly. And then so you would get a £1,000 bonus from the government each year. Also a limit on the age. You can open one when you're 18 and save into it, or you can open one between 18 and 40 and be investing until 50. And then if you don't take the money out to buy a home or when you're age 60, you do face this 25% penalty. So pretty hefty kind of exit fee. Although it should be said that doesn't apply in year one of the scheme. Other things to mention, I guess, are that it could be a cash ISA or stocks and shares. You can hold it alongside all of the other types of ISA. So you could have, you know, the innovative finance ISA, and you could have a cash ISA and a stocks and shares ISA and this. So that's pretty generous.
OK, so lots of options, but are many providers offering the LISA?
So in fact, no, it's been fairly controversial because very, very few stocks and shares platforms are offering it. In fact, only Nutmeg, Hargreaves and Lansdowne and the Share Centre from the kind of major platforms, and very few building societies, not really any major high street banks either. So there aren't many places that you can actually get one right now, though a lot of people and most brokers seem to be saying that they're either thinking about it or will be launching one before the end of the tax year.
OK, so not many providers, but at least with the investments you can hold in them, there's a wide range. Some people might say a bewilderingly wide range. So if you want to build up, let's say, a house deposit in your LISA, what sort of asset allocation should you have?
Well, I guess the first thing to think about whenever you're thinking about asset allocation is your time frame. Now, obviously, if you're someone trying to build up a house deposit, you're likely to kind of have a shorter time frame. If you're opening one, obviously, you're over 18. And you're likely to maybe be mid-20s, mid-30s if you're in this situation. So you might have a time horizon of between 5 to 10 years, which obviously isn't that long. So what we've said here is that you want to start out with UK equities, really, as you want to look to your domestic market first. So you might want to have kind of three or four. Start with UK equities, have some global equities in there, and then you can maybe either have a strategic bond fund, or others say maybe some other equities, maybe Asian equities or something, for a bit more growth.
Okay, and what would be some examples of these types of funds?
So UK equity funds that have been recommended. So there's Woodford Equity Income, obviously very well-known fund there. Investec UK Alpha, or Threadneedle UK Equity Income. So there's obviously equity income ones. Global funds include things like M&G Global Dividend, Artemis Global Income. And some people said as well that instead of having this kind of DIY portfolio where you do the asset allocation yourself, you could also look to a very well diversified single fund, for example, like Rick Capital Partners or Personal Assets, and some of those kind of farm out the investment decisions to external fund managers and will hold equities and bonds, so you're kind of getting a one-stop shop essentially with those.
Okay, now you can also use a LISA to save for retirement. So would the asset allocation for this kind of purpose be different?
Yeah, the asset allocation, whether you're saving for retirement or maybe if you are saving, you're very young and you have a grandparent or a parent kind of helping you out to put money in, and then you'll have a much longer time frame, the asset allocation is different. So if you're thinking kind of 10 years plus or retirement, you would need a lot more kind of very growthy equities in there. So you'd want exposure to emerging markets, exposure to Asia, and those kind of domestic and global tilts. You might want to have smaller companies in there as well, because the growth profile is likely to be better. And although all of that is slightly higher risk, you really do need to be taking more risk when you've got longer to invest.
Okay, and what would be maybe an example of one or two of the funds that you might want to have in that allocation?
So a combination of those, Asia, Aberdeen, Asian smaller companies in Asia, obviously. And then you've got smaller companies funds like Franklin UK Smaller Companies or Old Mutual UK Smaller Companies. And emerging markets, you could look at something like Lazard Emerging Markets.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that when you're kicking off the LISA, you could have maybe three individual funds or one multi-asset fund. Well, let's say when your LISA gets up to scale, roughly how many funds should you have?
Well, there's definitely no hard and fast rule about this, and it partly depends on what kind of investor you are. I mean, I think it's a clear way to think about it is start with one, two or three, as we've said. Certainly when you've got more than £2,000 in the portfolio, you can afford to hold more than one fund. But even when you've got a portfolio of up to kind of 50,000, you don't really need more than 10. And the very largest portfolios don't need to be more than 20 funds. You know, can get adequate diversification there without kind of watering down the impact of any one. The mistake a lot of investors make is to actually have too many holdings. So in fact, anywhere between kind of 10, 20 is fine, but you could even have a very small portfolio of five funds, and if they're well enough diversified, that's still fine. An interesting way that one person was talking to us about is it, or a different way of thinking about it rather, is to think about having a core of 3, 4, 5 funds that are well diversified, and then have a satellite kind of strategy so that when you see opportunities come up, tactical opportunities maybe, you can kind of dip in and out of those. So you think of having, you know, a solid core, a small number of funds, and then being flexible when it comes to investing in other themes and regions as you like them.
Okay. Monica, what kind of investment trust would you suggest for a long-term growth strategy in a tax wrapper such as an ISA?
For the long term, I would go all risk on. So for me, it's definitely equities, small caps. So names in there, good managers from BlackRock, Henderson. So you could consider private equity, although there I would say that you do need to look very well into the managers that are out there and consider the pros and cons. But yes, for the long term, I think it is risk on. If I was to think of a shorter time scale, you mentioned the 5 to 10 years, probably I would still go risk on, but also with a kind of absolute return type of bit of capital preservation in there. So the kind of names that I would be thinking of funds would be Asian Total Return, which is a fund run by Schroders. Multi-asset funds such as Seneca Global Income and Growth, personal assets. In emerging markets, there is a fund called Utilico Emerging Markets. The type of assets that it invests in have sort of those more resilient characteristics. And not least, high yield bonds. So I'm thinking of high yield bonds, kind of a bit of equity type return, but with better capital preservation. So a really good fund, which is, I think, part of the reason that is doing so well, is its size, because it's smaller, more nimble. It's New City High Yield. So there you get a great yield, about 7%. But also, if you compare it to equities over the longer term, it will have outperformed.
Okay, thank you, Kate and Monica. Some really useful suggestions. Now, another new tax allowance that has just come into effect is a so-called residence nil rate band. Emma, you've been looking at this. Can you tell us what it is and how it'll help investors?
Yes, that's right, Leonora. So the residence nil rate band boosts your individual inheritance tax-free entitlement by £100,000 on your death if you plan to leave a family home to children or grandchildren. And the £100,000 has come in this tax year, but this allowance is actually going to increase each year for the next three tax years. So by 2020, it will be £175,000. And the reason this is useful for investors is because right now everybody has an allowance of £325,000 on their estate before they have to pay inheritance tax. But with rising house prices, many more people are being drawn into paying a 40% tax bill, or their families been having to pay that tax bill on their death. So this new residence nil rate band will help some of these people pay less tax.
Okay, and who can you pass assets on to using the residence nil rate band?
Well, one of the key things about this new allowance is that it's not really available to everybody. It basically excludes people who don't have children, as you have to pass on your property onto direct descendants. And these include children, but also grandchildren, adopted children, stepchildren, or foster children. And the legislation also says that you're able to pass on to spouses of direct descendants, such as sons and daughters-in-laws.
Okay, so basically kids and grandkids. Okay. Are there any instances where you can't use the residence nil rate band?
Yes. So one of the big issues we discovered when we talked to chartered financial planners about this is that people who have set up discretionary trusts as part of a will not benefit from the new allowance. And this could be quite a big issue because in the past, people have used discretionary trusts to sort of tackle inheritance tax problems. So if you haven't updated your will for a few years, it's likely to include a reference to discretionary trusts. So you may want to look at it and get it updated, as you will not benefit from this quite generous allowance.
Okay. And are there any types of trusts that do benefit from the residence nil rate band?
Yes, there are. Some of these trusts include immediate post-death interest trusts, bereaved minor trusts, 18 to 25 trusts, and disabled person trusts. But as this is obviously quite a complicated area, you might want to get some independent financial advice about which types of trusts will be right for you.
Okay. Are there any other things then that you need to consider when looking to use the residence nil rate band?
Yes, there's one big other restriction of the residence nil rate band. It's that basically it only applies if your whole estate is worth less than £2 million. And that's the estate of your, you know, all your assets, not just your property. So it could include investments and cash. So even if you leave a house to children or grandchildren, if your estate is worth more than £2 million, the allowance will be reduced by £1 for every £2 that the value of the estate is more than the £2 million. So you're basically, the allowance will basically be tapered away. And if your estate is over 2.7 million, it will basically be lost completely.
Okay, that's not so good for people in that situation.
Yeah.
Is there anything they can do to reduce their inheritance tax bills if their assets mount up to more than 2 million?
Yes, there are. There's various tactics to legitimately reduce your inheritance tax bill. For example, you could consider investing in AIM portfolios or inheritance tax schemes that offer business property relief, as these can make you exempt from inheritance tax after 2 years. So that's something to consider.
Okay, thank you, Emma. And you can read more on how to use the residence nil rate band to cut your heirs' inheritance tax in this week's magazine and the website. That's all we've got time for today, so it just remains to thank Kate Bailey and Emma Ajimang, Deputy Personal Finance Editor and Personal Finance Writer at Investors Chronicle, and Monica Teppes, Director of Investment Companies Research at Cantor Fitzgerald. You can read more on how to build up a LISA and choose funds to invest in it, and ways to mitigate inheritance tax in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle and the website. Thank you for listening, and happy new tax year!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.